From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made this past weekend with the fourth in a series of summits focused on police-community relations in the Rochester area. The participants came from local police departments, the faith community, activism, the courts, and more. Reverend Lewis Stewart told WXXI that just a couple of years ago, he didn't think some leaders in local law enforcement would even want to sit in the same room as him, and now he's meeting with them routinely. That does not mean the problems have all been solved, but Reverend Stewart is optimistic that the dialogue holds potential. So what did they talk about this past weekend, and how do the various participants see the state of police-community relations? We've got a lot to talk about this hour, and Reverend Lewis Stewart is here, president of United Christian Leadership Ministry, also co-chair of the Coalition for Police Reform. Reverend Stewart, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Always good to have you. Iman Abbott is here. Iman is chapter director of the ACLU of New York and a co-chair as well of the Coalition. Iman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
And a couple of police chiefs. Mark Henderson, long time no see from the Brighton Police Department.
Thanks for having me back.
Been a few days. And Chief Richard Tantello, Irondequoit Police Department. Chief, welcome to you as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
Reverend Stewart, I keyed in on that moment where you told our Alex Crichton last week, you know, things felt different even 2 years ago. So
yes.
Let me ask you, go back to whether it's 2016, 2013. If you could listen in to private conversations among local police, what did you think they thought of you at the time?
I think they thought of me as a boogeyman. And I think that's a fair description and assessment, because I've been a critic, well, not only of the police, but of the criminal justice system per se. But I think it was fortuitous that in the paper I put out a call that said that we need to have a summit in light of issues that were going on in the community nationally at that particular time, especially with Eric Garner and several other incidents that had taken place. Got together with Mark Henderson, Brighton Chief of Police, and we said, all right, that's a goal. That's a goal. Because Mark at that time was also chairperson or president of the Monroe County Law Enforcement Council. We got together, we talked. In fact, we talked the same language. We may not have always agreed on everything, but we did and got together with Richard. And so we've had four summits so far.
2 years of work, Reverend.
2 years of hard work.
Very good.
Chief, did you think of him as a boogeyman?
I didn't think of him as a boogeyman. I certainly thought at the time that the Reverend Stewart had an opinion, had a concern. He issued this challenge for dialogue. It was right at the time that the 21st Century Policing Initiative Report was released by President Obama. And after reading in the article, I had met with Reverend Stewart relative to body cam policy language for the Brighton Police Department. And through that goal of having the summits, I reached out as the chair of the Law Enforcement Council to my fellow chiefs, and Chief Tantillo was the vice chair at that time. And we agreed to meet, and we agreed to work forward on coming to a summit. We knew that we could not just do this overnight. Chief Simonelli from the RPD was very active when I spoke to him. It was a desire of the RPD to be a participant. Deputy Chief Wayne Harris was assigned to our group, and I can recall our first meeting at the downtown Presbyterian Church in their meeting room. That's all correct. Windows, mm-hmm. Very hot outside, but we had some great dialogue on the inside.
Absolutely.
I asked about perceptions, Chief, because you know, I wonder if you yourself, if you'd occasionally see Reverend Stewart making comments about policing in the news in various places, and did you ever roll your eyes or think, come on, you don't get it?
Well, I think as individuals, we can look at any given issue and then roll our eyes or whatever. I think what was, in my opinion, what was happening, I think we needed to get together to explain. You know, I certainly listened. We all certainly listened to what the issues and the problems are. But to go along with the problems, you know, understanding it from a law enforcement perspective and from a police management perspective. We agreed in our first planning meeting to have a second, so that was a good sign. And we agreed that there was a whole bunch of national issues that we were discussing, as well as some local issues. And we agreed to take baby steps. And through that baby step led to our first summit in October of 2016.
All right, so here we are and just had the fourth. And the reason I wanted to kind of set up the dialogue this way is not because everything is solved or everything is perfect or even that everyone in this room will agree. Iman and Reverend Stewart are going to present some of what they perceive as the current challenges and problems. The chiefs may agree on some points and may have nuanced views of others, other ideas here. But we have to at least be able to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Stewart, at least we're doing that. But sometimes this community, we get too self-congratulatory just because we're talking.
Right.
Still got to result in action. So give us a little overview of what happened this past weekend, and then I'm going to have you and Iman tell us what you think the big outstanding issues are, and we'll work through it with the chiefs here. What happened this past weekend?
The first several summits were held at the U of R Advancement Center on East River Road. This time we decided to take it, to move it into the community itself. So it was held at First Church of God. And we curtailed the summit to one panel discussion dealing with the interrelationships between law enforcement and the criminal justice system, i.e. District Attorney's Office, the Public Defender's Office, the Office of the Conflict Defenders.
And Reverend, get right on that mic for me. Sorry, go ahead.
Office of the Conflict Defenders. And also we had a civil rights attorney there, Charlie Berkwit. Then we had two other workshops, basically, one dealing with implicit bias curriculum and community input into that, because we wanted to look at how do we impact police culture. And then what was the other one?
Use of force.
Use of force, mm-hmm. which was very appropriate discussion also. So those are the three things that we had. It was, I think this was a very well-attended summit. People were involved. Even at lunchtime, we had to call people back to the workshops because people were really engaged with each other talking about these particular issues.
All right, so let me ask the co-chairs of the Coalition for Police Reform, that's Reverend and Iman, what you view as the most significant outstanding issues. I mean, Iman, starting at the top, what is the most significant problem that you think is either unsolved or the most difficult to deal with between police-community relations right now?
So I think it's great that we had an opportunity to provide both officers and civilians to sit down and talk to each other, you know, without uniform on, without any of us wearing our badges. I think that way we all are speaking individual to individual, not necessarily police officer to individual, going from there, which is a great first step. But I think as we're trying to build that sort of a relationship, you know, it's just with any friend that you're trying to cultivate a good relationship with, right? You can't have any secrecy. You want to make sure that they're being honest with you, they're trustworthy, and vice versa, right? Like, it's happening from both sides. And I think one of the things that I'm thinking about when I'm thinking about these relationships that are being cultivated, and it's wonderful to see the community so interested in sitting down with the officers and having these conversations, is making sure that, number one, we know exactly what's happening in these police departments. We don't necessarily want to hear it from someone else. We want to make sure that this data and the way that, you know, procedures are enforced are actually, this information can be released to the public. And right now there are barriers to that through a variety of means, whether, you know, certain information on arrests and stops is not readily available. You know, they don't necessarily have systems put into place to make sure that that data can even be released to the public, or the fact that, you know, we're talking a lot about discipline. So if an officer is caught in a footage, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about that today, I'm sure, but if an officer is caught in a footage abusing someone, using the use of force against someone in what seems an unlawful manner, how can we make sure what actually happened in that circumstance? How can we make sure that if an officer actually was unlawful and was discriminated against someone just because he was black or brown, we can actually make sure that that officer is being held accountable to what it is that he had just done? And I think those are the things that are still predominant in the conversation that we're having at the community perspective. And we need to make sure, again, there's no secrecy and that we know what's actually happening in these departments. And so I think that's the next step, is really identifying, okay, what's happening, not just at a national movement, but what's happening in our own departments.
All right. So Chief Tantello, if there is an incident that Iman just described, mm-hmm. in which an officer uses force unnecessarily or excessively, particularly against a person who is, as she said, black or brown, is there the transparency in the system that will allow you to review it, to make sure you understand as a chief what happened, but also to allow the public to understand what happened? Do you feel that transparency currently exists in the system?
There is a certain level of transparency that exists, and in many instances, we may not have that data or all the information when an incident is first reported or responded to us. So the goal is transparency and the goal is accountability. As the chief of police, I am accountable for what occurs within the agency that I happen to lead, as well as every other chief executive officer of law enforcement. The more communication, collaboration, and connections that we have with people, the better that transparency is going to be and how we handle that situation. So to kind of just go back a step further to the very first question is, I first trained with Reverend Stewart some 30 years ago in regards to that. So that's where the relationship and the collaboration started to build. Were we completely successful in every aspect of what we did? No, but it gave us an excellent starting point. But more to the point that we're addressing right now is we have built capacity to be able to reach out to a network of community individuals if a situation were to be occurring in any particular agency, to reach out to those community activists or those community stakeholders to say, this is what we're dealing with. These are the facts as I have them as of now, and work with us through this process. Many of those situations involve legal issues, statutes. Many of those involve collective bargaining agreements and what we are required to adhere to in regards to that. But I don't think anybody at this table doesn't want to see transparency. Transparency, accountability, and reporting facts to those stakeholders that we all represent.
Okay, Iman, do you feel when you bring up transparency that, let's just take video as an example. Many departments, and I don't know, Chief, most departments locally using body-worn cameras now?
So I can tell you that I'm, from a Brighton perspective, all of our police officers wear body cameras. I'm aware of the RPD,
yep,
and Rich Irondequoit's, yep, in the process of...
Right. So Irondequoit Police Department right now is training our personnel in the utilization of the body-worn cameras. We're looking for full deployment, I would say, within the next 60 to 90 days. But the infrastructure is in place. Just not to digress to body-worn cameras, because we have met in regards,
sure,
to the policy,
mm-hmm,
for body-worn cameras. But, mm-hmm, as we started to roll this out, we found out that we had some infrastructure issues that we needed to contend with within the town's capabilities to handle all of this. So that kind of set us back a little bit. But again, that's been a conversation that we've had ongoing. So even though we may have met 6 months ago, we have tried to update both Iman and the Reverend in regards to where we are and how we're progressing. And it's not necessarily a stall tactic, because very honestly, our officers are anxious to have this piece of equipment.
Sure. And I think to some degree over the last few years, when we've talked about body-worn cameras, the mistake the public might make is thinking, well, that's just going to solve everything. Just have them wear cameras. We will now know exactly what happened every time, as if the capacity for video storage isn't an issue, or even the question of when the cameras are on and off. The dark view of police that sometimes you hear in some communities, and again, fair or not, might be a caricature, is that officers have discretion, and that if they're going to be in a situation that gets rough, they can just turn the camera off. And what the Chief Tantello is saying is, you want transparency, everyone wants transparency, no one's going to intentionally do that. The question, I guess, is, are you trusting so far, Iman, that what you're seeing with body-worn cameras, that you're going to get access to the video when you need it, that it's going to be used appropriately?
Yeah, I think I would say to the two officers that are sitting here today is that we would hope that their model is even stronger than the one that is used by the Rochester Police Department.
Why?
I think because of the issues that are coming up with it. I mean, one of the concerns we had is, I don't think anyone thought that the body-worn cameras were actually going to resolve all issues. I don't think they were going to help us see everything that the police departments were up to or what all the civilians were going to be doing as well. We thought they were going to help people hold themselves accountable, whether it was the officer that knew that the body-worn camera was on, who might be a little more patient, who might use these sort of, you know, tactics to try to de-escalate situation if he could, he or she could. And then there was also the opportunity to hold the civilian more accountable, which I understand, you know, establishing that sort of due process on both sides. But what we're seeing at the Rochester Police Department is that the that regardless of the footage being available or not, right now we're having concerns when it comes to foiling that sort of footage. So right now,
when she says foiling, she means freedom of information law, getting access to. Yeah.
Yes. Is that there's a lot of information that is actually being redacted, and from my understanding is that the city law department and the Rochester Police Department have actually decided to redact all audio and blur out any sort of quote unquote sensitive information. Sensitive information being any sort of information regarding address, personals, you know, social security numbers, whatever else you want to include under that. But when you're thinking about it, you're redacting almost nearly everything in the original footage that's being foiled, and you're not getting anything. You're not actually releasing anything to the public right now, which is actually a lot of incidents, you know, a lot of these incidents, a lot of these footage, and the video footage that's being captured on these body-worn cameras and being released to the public is releasing absolutely nothing, which to us says, okay, you have all these hours of footage stored on a server used by the RPD in the city. Then what is it being used for if it's not going to be accessed by the public? These uses of technology are not going to be another tool of surveillance. And right now, that's what they sound like, and that's what they're being used for. And we're concerned that if we don't have the proper policy in place and we don't make sure that the Freedom of Information Law is implemented and you know, in the right way, then we're actually doing absolutely nothing. We're just adding another piece of technology to surveil the public. And that, to me, is incredibly concerning.
All right, let me ask the Reverend for his thoughts on that, and then we'll ask both the chiefs to respond. What are you seeing with body-worn cameras? Do you agree with him on there?
I agree certainly with Iman on that. In November of last year, the mayor and myself and another party signed a memorandum of understanding called the Community Justice Advisory Board. The Community Justice Advisory Board is composed of about 9 to 10 members of the community who sit down on a quarterly basis with Lieutenant Prokowski and now LaRon Singletary, who's the deputy chief of police, to deal with body-worn camera footage and everything that goes along with it. And I'm seeing the same thing that Iman is seeing, especially with the problems related to FOIL and other issues. And so the fact is you can't get at basically accountability and transparency if the footage is being redacted severely. That's my problem.
Okay, Chief Henderson.
So I heard the term FOIL being used, and the Freedom of Information Law has some specific prohibitions to releasing certain information. And anything that is evidence in an ongoing criminal prosecution or anything that is relevant and pertinent to an ongoing investigation cannot be released. I am not going to speak for the RPD. I'm aware that they're into their program. I have seen video footage that's in the public domain. I certainly, from a Brighton police chief perspective, Iman, if you were to FOIL a matter that has criminal overtures that is being prosecuted by the district attorney's office, I can't release that to you. If it's a matter that's currently being investigated, I can't release that to you. There's very strict guidelines. The redaction of private information, it's the same thing if I had a written report that you asked for and it had personal information of a victim on it, I could not put that in the public domain. So it sounds on its face, well, let's release the body cameras pursuant to FOIL, but there's certain restrictions under FOIL that we as the chief of, me as the Brighton chief of police, before we can release body cam footage, we have to adhere to the FOIL process.
I actually agree 100% with that, but these redactions are actually not justified based off of a criminal investigation or whatnot. This is just literally the regular protocol that the city is using right now when anyone FOILs any sort of camera footage. And that's, to me, what is slightly concerning, is that they're saying it's easier for them to just redact all the audio from a footage and blur out anything with sensitive information, which I actually don't agree with that, at least that aspect of it. But when you're redacting all the audio in a footage, it's incredibly problematic. What are you going to hear? What are you going to see? I mean, if faces are blurred out of both the cop and the civilian, you're not going to see anything. And we're not actually being able to use this sort of tool as, you know, an accountability tool. And that's, to me, what's so concerning. Because right now we've given them the opportunity to use these body-worn cameras. And unfortunately, it's not working out in favor of the public.
Okay, Chief Henderson, audio, should that be included or redacted?
if you're asking from a Brighton standpoint, and I know as you described the current, I'm not aware of the current policy.
Yeah, Mark is not here to speak for the Rochester Police Department. Chief is speaking for Brighton and Chief Tantella for Arundel. Okay. Yep.
So the Brighton policy is if it's not one of the exceptions to FOIL, we will release the body cam footage containing audio.
With the audio. Will you redact sensitive information, whether it's addresses, otherwise?
We attempt to do that, yes, with the current system that we have.
And redacting sensitive information is okay, so long as you, in your own procedures and policies, have that written down and you describe or define what personal information actually is.
Okay, and so I want to ask you one more question on this. I want to get Chief Tantello's thoughts on what he's hearing as Arundel gets ready to roll out their own system with it. And Iman, to some degree, this is a little unfair because I don't have someone from RPD here, and we'll follow up with them. But it sounds to me like your frustration, I don't want to speak for you, but it sounds to me like your frustration is either, well, it's one of two things. It's either you think that a well-intended system that was supposed to be about accountability for everybody, for officers, for the public, for the public to see, for civilians, has become more of a surveillance tool because of well-intended but sort of bungled management of it, or is it more nefarious? Do you think that the people running this program are intentionally withholding when they should not?
No, I don't want to say it's intentional in any way. I actually just think
so it's
a new program.
It's a learning
process. Yeah, but how much time do you have for learning a program? I mean, this has been going on for more than a year. We waited. We sit down, and I commend the mayor, I commend city council and the police department for sitting down with us and talking to us for a very long time about this. But I think, it's time to actually make sure that this program is running as well as it can. Mm-hmm. And if there are issues, we are going to bring them up. And I know that we have been. And that on the conversation around even FOIL, this is a fairly new conversation. Fairly new information has been released to us from the public, at the ACLU's office. And we want to make sure that we're addressing these issues through the conversations we have with RPD and the mayor and city council. And so I think that's important to just recognize that, yes, it's new. Yes, I don't believe it's intentional in any way. I mean, I would really hope not. But I do want to address that, right now, to me, and I'm not just trying to be a radical in any way, but it does seem like another surveillance tool that could be used.
Okay. Chief Tantello, how do you feel about it from Arundel's perspective?
Well, we certainly want to be as transparent as possible. We certainly model the Brighton policies and procedures. They've been successful with that, and we'll be moving in that direction, and we want to be able to release whatever information we can that is legally we're able to do so, as well as meeting all of the FOIL requirements that we have to adhere to. The key component to everything is the fact that community engagement is critical. Building that public trust with the people that we serve is critical for us. We see the positive byproduct of that when we're out doing investigations and having collaboration with neighborhoods, neighborhood associations, community groups, and things of that nature. Now, Mark and I happen to sit on the Center for Dispute Settlement Police Advisory Board, and this is just at a recent meeting. I can't necessarily validate it. It was a statement or a statistic that was given out that since the body-worn cameras have been deployed with the Rochester Police Department, this is CDS advising us on this matter, they indicated that the number of complaints has been reduced. Now, you can read into that statistic in many different ways, but it just seems to be a very positive direction that we're going in. And the other thing that under lessons learned with whether it be Ferguson or other communities, that when we hold on to a videotape longer than we should or don't release it in such a manner where it helps to at least address the community concerns, we see the negative consequences of that inaction. And I think that's forefront for all of us as chief executives or police chiefs, if you will, to make sure that we work collectively together. I don't know that we have a perfect system. We have much to work through, but I think we're on the right track with that.
All right, so let me ask the co-chairs for final thoughts on police, body-worn cameras, and then there's plenty of other things to discuss. Do you agree, Reverend, that this is potentially reducing complaints and that is a good thing?
Well, I think the national statistics say that it does reduce some complaints, which is, I agree it does. But let me just say this. I think we're talking about the democratization of police forces around the country as well as in our own area. That's number one. And in order to do that, we have to build trust and legitimacy, which is one of the pillars of the 21st Century Task Force on Policing. The other thing we have to be honest about is that the police are a paramilitary force. We accept that. But the whole issue is, how do you have this interaction between the community and the police force, which is going to build a trust and accountability? That's the main issue. And that's what we're trying to do relative to these summits. The other thing is the fact that I think people erroneously felt that body-worn cameras would somehow be the panacea to answer all problems, but they're not. They're just one tool in the toolkit to deal with these issues of accountability and transparency. I think the other thing is that people in the community, like Thomas Jefferson once said, we must continually be involved, continually monitor, continually be vigilant about what is happening in our community.
Okay, Iman?
I think I'd just like to say that, again, if body-worn cameras are in, if there's a policy put into place and it's enforced correctly, it could be a great tool. We have seen that happen in other places around this country. If they are not, they're just another use of, they're just another surveillance technology. Right. But then I also want to address, you know, I know that you just mentioned the statistics for the Center for Dispute Settlement, and they're seeing a decline in complaints. I do want to just say that there are people who are incredibly frustrated with the system and are deciding not to complain against the police, regardless of what is happening to them, which could also be why these number of complaints are going down. Or the fact is that the process is so long, and people kind of freeze, you know, themselves and don't necessarily know what to do. They don't have the time or the ability to even make it down to a court date or to a meeting with somebody at CDS. And I think the process is just too long. And I think that's also, you know, discouraging people from filing a complaint. I mean, I mentioned this at the summit, but we've seen, actually, this is a little bit different, but I mean, we've seen what this sort of, the conversation around police and community has actually driven different cities, most impoverished cities, places out in like Detroit and, you know, in Chicago, that there are a decline in 911 calls because of the, you know, this jaded idea of what the police are actually trying to do for people.
A distrust. Okay,
yes.
Because this is where I wanted to kind of pivot next, away from just the cameras, but to a general feeling of what's going on in the community. You told the Democrat and Chronicle this weekend, we have to acknowledge that there's distrust. What did you mean by that? This is what you're talking about here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think when we're going back to the summit, I think I want to say, and I do want to commend the officers who are actually willing to sit around the table. They have acknowledged that distrust. That's why they're at the table. They want to fix it. They want to get rid of that sort of barrier that's set between them. Now, not all officers are bad. Not everybody is out to get somebody. And, you know, vice versa, that civilians actually also aren't. There's a lot of stereotypes of certain people of different communities, which is why we have this racial bias that exists, which is why that, you know, we have such racial, there's so many cases of racial profiling in different departments and whatnot. And I think that's the sort of distrust that I'm talking about right here. But as long as we break down those barriers and we change and we have the shift in culture and understanding of one another, we truly can make a big difference in the way that the police and the community perceive one another.
When you say distrust, though, who specifically distrusts police? Communities of color?
They do not trust the police.
Absolutely. Communities of color. And here is the problem with that, because there are some groups who want the abolition of law enforcement, which to me is insane. If anybody needs the presence of police in the community, it certainly is communities of color. But the fact is that we want police in the community who are going to treat people in the community fairly, with justice, and with honor.
And dignity,
and not brutalize people. That's what we're asking for.
Now, these are strong topics here, and in a moment I'm going to ask the chiefs to respond to some of this, but let me also bring the conversation to a recent discussion we had, including some of the folks from an organization doing really hard work and important work in this community, and that's Teen Empowerment. And they had a 17-year-old on the program from Teen Empowerment named Kiara Johnson, 17 years old, who, you know, when you hear about, this has been going on for years, about the term, and I'm going to use a term just that I hear, but it's not one that I fully understand. It's snitching. The notion of, we're going to work with police? Are we going to tell them information that we have? Are we going to let them know where someone might be or who might have done something? The police frustration? Are people not cooperating or et cetera, et cetera? Kiara, and I'm trying to sum up here, but I thought this was so interesting. She pointed to the Starbucks case in Philadelphia. Two black men get arrested because they didn't order a coffee. And then one of the first things that the police chief does, who happens to be a man of color, is defend the officers. Now, a few days later, he came back and said, okay, that was knee-jerk. I shouldn't have done that. But Kiara says, look, we're so used to police protecting themselves first, even when they've done something wrong, that yes, there are times where we're going to protect one another in our own communities, even if we've done something wrong. If we don't perceive that the people with the power, the government agents with the guns, are going to be honest when they've done something wrong. So you want us to work with you and give you information? We want to believe that you will be honest when you've made a mistake. I thought that was pretty profound, and I wonder if you agree with that, Reverend.
I certainly do agree with that. I think she's summing up the sentiment of many young black and brown people in the community. I mean, let's face it, and I believe Chief Tantello and Chief Henderson recognize this too. They're enlightened men. They see the fact that oftentimes police will do something harsh, inhumane, like what happened with Michael Brown, etc., and then they get off. And that's what concerns a lot of not only young black people, but it concerns black people in general. Well, if the police are going to protect themselves, but not only just law enforcement, if the criminal justice system are going to protect police from being punished, then we also need to protect our own. Now, the issue is if there is someone committing murder in the black community, then I believe, and I will say, you need to come forth and identify who that particular person is, because too many killings, too many murders, too many homicides are happening in black and brown communities, and it needs to stop. But getting from that is the fact, see, both of these issues are intertwined, because really you can't have one without the other. If you want police in the community to patrol the community, and with dignity, and with fairness, and with justice, then people are going to have to come forth if they want a reduction of crime in the community. So I would say, yes, I agree with what the young sister had to say.
Yeah, all right. So, all right, Chiefs Tantello and Chief Henderson, I'll start with you. What is your message, either when you meet privately with Reverend Stewart, leaders in communities of color who want to feel like, number one, you're going to treat us with dignity, and number two, if you make a mistake, you will be honest about it, and you will, you know, your officers will not get off.
So 2 years ago, Reverend, when we first met, mm-hmm. our goal was to understand law enforcement, understand the community, and understand the concerns of the community. And when we would meet in our planning meetings, we'd talk about this very subject. Law enforcement, community member, police-citizen interaction, and that perhaps it was lacking, and where we are today is an outgrowth of disrespect. It's an outgrowth of past behavior, and we started to talk about how do we change that perception and how do we change the interaction between law enforcement and citizens. And we talked about the need for training. We talked about the need for hiring representative police agencies and the goal for represented police agencies. I also talked about understanding biases and implicit biases. We have built in some training in the Brighton Police Department that I think goes a long way to establish trust in the community. And I think we, as a profession, have some work to do. But as a police chief, I am not one that's going to tolerate behavior that is rogue. I am not going to tolerate behavior that is disrespectful. We'll take affirmative action and disciplinary action to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Do you trust that, Reverend?
Yes. Yes.
Because, that's important, yeah.
I trust what Chief Henderson has said, and also Chief Tantello, in the sense that these men, I have known them for the past 2 years. We've had some incidents that have taken place, and we've gotten together and talked about those things. I managed to rely upon Chief Tantello here because there was an incident that took place in Irondequoit, and we got together, we talked about it, and in a sense, he advocated for that particular person, which he did. And Mark and I have done the same thing, so that the summit has really gotten past, I would say, certain stereotypical perceptions, and to see each other as human beings. The question is, how do we get that to a trickle down to rank and file officers? How do we get that to deal with the silence of police culture and the protecting of each other when it comes to issues like that? I mean, these things happen. I they're well aware of it. We have to deal with it.
Okay, and so on the flip side of that, mm-hmm. if I could, is I've heard members in law enforcement, not necessarily the chiefs in this room, I don't know how they feel about this particular issue, but I've heard members of law enforcement say, it's like anything that has a reputation that's rough, it takes a while to change it, and it takes some leadership to change that. So, for example, the Irondequoit Mall. I mean, Chief Tantello, what were the rumors for years at the Irondequoit Mall? That people were hiding under your car to slash your ankles. I don't know that that ever happened once. Did it ever happen one time?
It did not happen.
I mean, but how many times did you hear that rumor?
I heard it many times.
All the time. Those reputations, and it took forever to even start to change that. I don't know if it ever did. So it's like anything with a negative reputation. So if there's a perception in communities of color that officers will get off, if they treat you rough, no consequence. What you're saying is you've got relationships now with the chiefs of at least a couple local departments, and you trust them.
Yeah.
And that they're going to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yes.
I've heard officers say, I want to see the Reverend Stewarts of the world working in their own communities to say, hey, things are changing. Things are changing. And is that perception changing?
Well, things are changing a little slowly.
Okay.
But I'll tell you what is okay. hard to change. It's hard to change systems. And that's the issue.
Okay.
You can change hearts better than you can change systems. And from changing hearts to moving about to changing systems, that's a deeper transformation that is going to have to prevail over a long period of time.
You're talking courts, too. You're talking
yes,
the criminal justice
absolutely.
System.
Absolutely.
Okay, Chief Tantello, go ahead.
Just back to this point here, in referencing, if you will, Reverend Stewart, we're really a community of one. Even though we may have, you know, some jurisdictional boundaries for our communities from a taxing and, you know, school district setting and things of that nature, we're such a mobile community that when we advocate for the entire community. And I will reinforce the fact that many chiefs, nearly all of the chiefs and the sheriff, have really, and the state police major, have been very supportive of what we're working toward. To talk about public trust, and that's always been an issue, and one of the things that we had the advocacy aspect of this, but even prior to that, Reverend Stewart, we had the opportunity to meet and look at a way that we could offer, if you will, some sort of an independent or non-police related complaint referral form because of what was mentioned here as well. And Reverend Stewart, with his leadership, as well as Supervisor Bellow and then Supervisor Seeley, came up with a mechanism where individuals can, if you will, submit a personnel complaint, can submit a community feedback form directly to the town hall and bypass the police for at least the initial aspect of that. And what that does is provide, in my opinion, a very critical oversight piece to this. So therefore, if it comes into the police agency, the leading elected official of the community may or may not be aware of that. But in this particular situation, they are. And I have a responsibility to them. I am accountable to them, as I am to the citizen making the complaint. So in my opinion, that additional layer of accountability to make sure that we advocate in an appropriate way to offer transparency and justice and making sure that there's dignity and respect on the part of both individuals involved in the situation and working through that. I'm not proud to say this, but we have disciplined officers and we have officers that no longer work for us as a result of things that they did. So that to me lends to, I'm hoping, the legitimacy piece and the fact that they can be trusted because they will take appropriate action.
Okay, so and now let's hit two parts of this where Reverend Stewart and Iman might want to talk about solutions. You talked about systemic change you want to see, and you heard the chief talk about implicit bias, and whether you think I don't know what's actually happening in terms of training in departments. If it's mandatory now, if it happens regularly, but Reverend, what do you see there?
Well, there are a couple of things.
Yeah.
Number one, I think 50A, and Iman can talk about that, and so can Mark and yeah. Richard. 50A needs to be changed. That is a civil service law, which in a way shields police, and it countermands accountability and transparency. So 50A needs to be changed, but that needs to be changed on the state level. I think secondly is that one of the things that we try to get to the heart of at the summit this past weekend was community input into an anti-racist education and training curriculum to be used at the police academy level for all police agencies in the county. Now, what they call implicit bias. So that needs to be institutionalized. We need to get to that, and we need to do that because we've got to look at the culture of policing. And because sometimes when I worked for the Department of Corrections there 20 years, one of the things is a lot of the officers who were white, who were COs, did not encounter anybody black, not unless they were criminal. And so they formed in their heads the stereotype that all black men are criminals. So these are some of the things that need to be changed.
Yeah, or if I encounter a black man, he's likely to be a criminal.
He's likely to be a criminal.
Likely to be more dangerous or
yes.
more threatening.
Yes.
In the same way that people who grow up in mostly white, wealthy communities, you see someone walking down the street. You may move to the other side of the street, mm-hmm. not even really knowing why. Mm-hmm. That's part of the implicit bias that we have.
Well, not only that. That has happened to me recently. All right? That has happened to me at Wegmans, where I'm standing at the deli counter and everything like that, and a white woman is there with her husband, and she has her purse in the cart, and I'm there, and then the husband moves over in between the cart where her purse is and myself, like I'm going to steal.
It's interesting you say that, because I saw you at Wegmans. My son and I were at Wegmans. We saw Reverend Stewart, and I said, "This is a very important man in this community. Come shake his hand." So, but I don't mean to make light of it. It's real.
Yeah, it's
and
real.
It's serious.
Yes.
And so, Chief Henderson, you want to tell us a little bit about implicit bias and the training that does or does not happen?
I can talk about what we just did as an agency in Brighton. I can talk about the overall training from a New York State perspective for new hires in law enforcement. In May, the Brighton Police Department undertook anti-bias policing training, and the subject of implicit bias, understanding how things along your life can impact the way that you think now, can lead to an implicit bias, and how that can come out as you may not mean it to be racist, you may not mean it to be anything other than an interaction, but so at the conclusion of that two-part series, I had a better understanding what implicit bias was. I had a better understanding on how things are just the way that you stand, you know, the stance for law enforcement, whether you mean to put your hand on a belt or it lands on a taser or whatever, how that can be perceived. So we are in a better place as an agency for that training, and we will continue, and I will continue to look for training opportunities. I do agree with the Reverend, and I do believe at the entry-level police academy, there currently is curriculum that talks about bias and anti-bias behavior. It can always be better. Just like our officer safety and our tactical response to major situations, we continually evaluate that and look for better training opportunities. And I share that goal with Reverend Stewart that, you know, perhaps a different form of training is needed in addition to what we currently do. And I do think that the community plays an important role in training. And I am aware that there are aspects of training where members of the community actually come into the new recruit police training and talk about perceptions that are happening in the community and what these officers can do to change those perceptions, first to understand them, and then when they get out of the academy and into the community, be cognizant of them.
Okay, and 50A is something that came up, and I'd like Iman Abbott to tell us a little bit more about when you hear 50A, the Reverend brought it up here, tell the audience what it is and what you think can or should change with it.
Yeah, so it's a New York State law that actually addresses the police disciplinary records and says that officers and departments don't have to release personnel records to the public in regards to their discipline. But what Reverend is actually talking about is a movement that a lot of organizations are actually encouraging, standing behind, and that's to repeal 50A. I mean, as I was talking about earlier, you know, we can talk and talk, but if we can't see the information and the data or what is actually happening, I think we're not going to go very far. We're going to find ourselves with a lots of walls to try to break down. And I think 50A is one of the toughest fights to fight. But I think it's an opportunity that if departments across the state agree with the community on, is that if you want to add transparency, you reform or repeal 50A. And I think that that's something right now that is happening. It has been put in front of the New York State Assembly through a I don't know the exact bill at the top of my head, but I mean, it's there, it's available, and we can make it happen if we decide to put enough pressure on our legislators to reform.
Can I weigh in on the 50A discussion? It's not that we don't want to release records. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the context of the statute, there is a mechanism in place for the release of police officer performance records. Disciplinary actions are part of this, and it involves the judiciary. And I agree with you that there needs to be legislative change if the state of Florida has open access to all police records, mm-hmm. complete access. The way that the civil rights law is written under 50A, even if I thought it was in the best interest of the public to release police officer records, I can't do that. Legally, there's prohibitions and there's sanctions that are defined in the statute. So if we're going to, and we both share a goal for the ability to release records, that statute, as it's written, needs to change.
Which is exactly why I'm saying you repeal the law. But I think that's also, it goes back down to what you asked me first, Evan. And it's what is most important to the community. And right now it's to know that we are actually holding these officers accountable. Mm-hmm. And if we can't see that, we're not going to know what's happening, and no one's going to trust anybody, and we're going to be at the same spot we started in.
All right, before we lose the hour here, just let me read an email from a listener named Dan who says, regarding implicit bias, the Supreme Court recently ruled that if an officer fears for his or her life, they can qualify for immunity from criminal prosecution regardless of the actions of the outcome. And that kind of ruling makes the work your panel is doing much harder. I'm not familiar with that exact ruling, but I will say this. The notion of fearing for an officer's life, I am not a police officer. I am grateful for the work of police officers and their departments. And I will continue to say that, just as Reverend Stewart said, you know, you can't get to the point of thinking we need to abolish all the police, that especially communities of color need a strong and respectful police force. So I'm grateful for the work that officers do. But I do look at cases, and I'll give you just an example. One of the best known recent cases is Philando Castile, in which the officer said, you know, I feared for my life. I smelled marijuana. This was a case where if this person could smoke marijuana around a child, what was he capable of? And he said he had a gun. And well, this was just a man who had a gun and just wanted the officer to know, you know, I'm permitted to have one. I've got one, you know, and seven gunshots. And the officer was scared for his life. And to me, that looks like sort of a slam dunk case of bias. I don't know. And I don't know if you think it's fair for me to ask you, Chief Henderson, but in these cases, this is where I think communities of color think that's like a get out of prosecution free card.
And I understand that. And I certainly, you know, whether it's a training, a shift in the training, certainly the case that I believe the person that wrote you the email was the Graham versus O'Connor case.
Okay.
that changed the police use of force to a reasonable standard. And I certainly understand the concern. And, you know, maybe as a police chief, I can do a better job of teaching de-escalation. I can do a better job of introducing the concept of putting time into a situation so you can think through a process. Unfortunately, you know, we have this example. We also have a number of examples of police officers, law enforcement officers being killed in the line of duty. And I don't know if that time is something that would open those officers up to greater risk. You know, I certainly I look at that legal standard. I also I was originally trained before that court case, and we had a continuum, and we had to meet certain steps before you could go to the next step. I don't know if that is the answer. We kind of talked about that at the summit the other day. Perhaps the use of force and the ability should be defined a little bit more specific, but will that lead to additional death in law enforcement? That's one counter that we heard on Saturday. That's some of the rationale that I read in the literature. Evan, I don't have an easy answer for you, but I understand that feeling.
Can I just wait? I know we're short on time, but
no,
weigh
ahead,
in on
Keith.
That. But from the perspective of, you know, what training has done, as we look at these various situations that occur nationwide, and we're very fortunate to have an excellent police academy here, if you will, police training site. So we look at lessons learned. We look at reality-based training, putting officers, law enforcement officers, in situations that are real, to raise that stress level, to be able to determine how they're going to react and have a successful reaction to that, and also utilizing the de-escalation techniques. Because sometimes what we find as we evaluate situations in other communities, the level of training that those personnel are experiencing is not the level of training we go through.
Okay. Iman?
Yeah, I just want to add that I think we have to look at the foundation and the grounds to which these circumstances are, we're even falling under these circumstances. And it goes back down to the way that the law defines, you know, how these encounters even happen. And if an officer defines as someone as being reasonably suspicious or whatever that may mean. And we were talking about the discretion that's left up to the officer. Right now, the law says it's up to the officer to defy if someone is suspicious or not. What does suspicion even mean? And right now, I think what we're seeing, the data that's being released, you know, data doesn't tell us everything, but it does tell us something, is that people who are suspicious are black or brown. And yet, we're not sitting here and actually making sure that this has changed. I mean, I think it's great that we have these tools and trainings in place, but if the culture does not change, we do not change regardless of whatever training is put into place. And if we're not holding them accountable, then it's not going to be, like, we can't, it just seems silly to me that as public servants, you know, this is a government agency. We hold our elected officials, other elected officials accountable to this, but we must hold the police accountable the same way.
Well, Reverend Stewart began these conversations and they continue. And as we said at the outset, there's not going to be total agreement from everyone in this room, but they continue to work at this. I know the police chiefs here appreciate that, being at the table with you, Reverend Stewart, and we do too. These conversations aren't easy. Thank you for being here, and let's continue it.
Thank you for having me.
We'll see you soon.
For having us.
Chiefs Tantello and Mark Henderson from Brighton, Aronica, thank you so much for being here, Chiefs.
Thank you for having us.
And Iman Abid from, I kept saying the NYCLU. It's the chapter leader of the ACLU of New York. Titles.
It's fine.
Thank you. Thanks
Thank
for being
you.
Here. More connections coming up.